a few ideas of his own, and a half hour before sunset, seven Border Patrol trucks bumped off the highway down into the dry fields south of where the second shooter was. "Don't have much time," Lucas shouted to the drivers. "We have to move right along. You shooters, you guys stay close to the trucks. Don't stick anything out but one eyeball." The trucks arrayed themselves across the field, spaced 15 yards apart, giving them a sweep of more than 100 yards. A Border Patrolman stood on the back left corner of each truck carrying a rifle, using the truck for cover. The truck drivers sat in the passenger seats, low enough that nothing but their eyes were above the dashboard. Each of them had a traffic cone on the driver's side, the tip of the cone pressed against the gas pedal. It was ugly and awkward, but it worked. They had no way to brake, but wouldn't be traveling any faster than 2 or 3 miles an hour. Even at that slow pace, they'd cover 100 yards in a bit more than a minute, and only had to cover a couple 100 yards to sweep the field. The drivers were put in the passenger seat because everybody agreed that if the shooter opened up on the trucks, he was most likely to try to hit the driver in the driver's seat. They used traffic cones to push on the pedals because it was what they had that would work. When everybody was lined up, Lucas looked at the lowering sun and yelled, "Let's do it!" Lucas was behind the truck closest to the buildings, carrying Bob's rifle. The trucks began edging forward, Lucas and the Border Patrolmen walking behind, their rifles already at their shoulders, ready to fire. Darling had shot at the two cops, the short white guy and the tall black woman, hitting one, he thought, from the way the woman screamed and the guy went down. He hoped that the Border Patrol hadn't yet become fully involved with lots of personnel, that if he could rid himself of the cops from the silver SUVs, he might have a little more freedom of movement. When the heavyset cop went down and was dragged out of sight, he began moving north as quick as he could without giving away his position, snaking along in the grass. He stopped once to call Poole and tell him what was going on.
"I don't know where you are," Poole said. "I think I might have hit one of the cops. I saw him peeking out from behind one of the buildings. If there were only two or three of them in those trucks, we might have knocked out two of them."
"I'm going to get as close as I can to those glass buildings," Darling replied. "If I get the chance, I'll rush them, see if I can take them out. It's about our only chance."
"All right. I'm in this concrete bunker. I can see the tops of both of the roofs. If they try to put a sniper up there, I'll clean them off for you. Let me know if you break through."
"Soon as it happens," Darling said. "We've only got maybe 30 or 40 minutes until sundown." Darling hung up, and still with a bit of hope in his heart, he continued crawling north, trying not to leave a rippling motion in the grass and weeds. He was almost even with the back of the nearest building when he heard the trucks rushing down the highway. He risked a look over the weeds, saw the line of Border Patrol trucks heading south and then turning out onto the field. He said, "God damn it!" aloud, crawled a few feet into a dense cluster of dead dark brown weeds, and used the cover to take a longer look. The trucks were spreading out across the far end of the field, their headlights pointing toward him. They were going to try to flush him, he thought, and they'd do it, too, if he let them get close. The brown weeds were looser than the yellow grass, and after considering his dwindling options, he carefully moved into a prone shooting position, lined up on the driver's side window of the middle truck, and fired a single shot. He immediately heard men shouting. He lined up on another truck and squeezed the trigger again. The trucks stopped rolling. Darling, satisfied for the moment, turned around to begin crawling north again. He had moved 50 feet when he heard the truck engines working again behind him. A few more feet, and he came to a trampled area in the yellow grass. He'd have to cross it, and when he did...
He peeked again and saw people standing behind the glass in the nearest building. He wasn't sure if they were inside the building or on the far side. Whichever it was, they would be able to see him when he tried to cross the bald spot. He got on the phone. "Hey, man, I'm trying to get up north. It'd help a whole lot if you could put a few shots through the windows of the second building. There are people either in there or on the other side looking out here at these fields."
"Give me 15 seconds.
15 seconds later, he heard Poole open up and the glass shattering in the domed building. And he low-crawled across the bald spot just as he had been taught in the core. On the far side, he disappeared back into the weeds, now aiming at the space between the two big buildings, the place where the two cops had been when he shot at them. If he could get into the gap, and if there weren't many cops, he might be able to break back through. O'Brien was on the phone to Lucas after checking by radio with the truck drivers. "Nobody hurt. We're all okay. Keep moving. I think this is gonna work." The trucks began moving again, still at the slow walking pace, and Lucas kept the rifle up. Then a patrolman, two or three trucks over, shouted,
"I think I saw him. I think he's angling toward the space between the buildings. He's maybe 25 yards into the field," Lucas shouted back. "If you got a clear line, if you're not gonna hit anything else, put a couple shots in there. See if he breaks out."
The patrolman did that. Bap, bap, bap. Lucas, who was looking toward the area, thought he saw a wave-like motion in the weeds, somebody moving on his knees and elbows. He aimed Bob's M4 at the area and fired 4 more shots. Bap, 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 bap. A half-second later, the trucks took 10 or 12 incoming shots from a different angle from the northeast.
"Everybody okay? Everybody okay?"
Lucas shouted. Everybody was unharmed except for one truck driver who'd taken some windshield glass in his shoulder above his vest but said he was okay. O'Brien, who was with the trucks north of the big buildings, called.
"Did you get a fix on those shots?"
"Came down from the northeast, but can't say exactly where from. There's a whole bunch of concrete bunkers over there. Must be part of the old fort. I think it could be in one of the northern ones," O'Brien said.
"Those aren't bunkers. They're artworks."
"What?"
"Artworks, but they're perfectly fine bunkers if you think of them that way."
Lucas was looking back at the area next to the building and again thought he saw movement. He shoved the phone in his pocket and brought his rifle up, and at the same instant, 2 other border patrolmen fired from behind the trucks. Lucas added 2 shots. The first sequence of 3 shots whistled over Darling's head, and he thought then of throwing up his hands and quitting. If Poole was killed, there'd be no witnesses to the shootings in Biloxi, and if he hadn't killed either of the cops he'd shot at, he'd be looking at years in prison, but maybe not the needle. With his wife on the outside with a ton of cash, he'd have at least a possibility of busting out of prison. A corrupt guard, a prison gang with connections. Then the second deck of 4 shots came in, 3 narrowly missing. The 4th hit him right in the asshole, he thought, knifing up into his guts and then out around his navel. The pain was blinding, and he curled up against it and cried out once, "Ah!" He kicked once, twice against the pain, and 2 more shots came in. One hitting him in the leg, the other knocking the heel off his boot and twisting his ankle. He couldn't crawl anymore. He heard the trucks coming, the relentless sound of their engines. He touched his stomach and his hand came away soaked with blood. He got the phone out, called Poole, said,
"I'm done for. I'm hit bad. My guts are all over the place. If you need to make a move, I'm gonna sit up and hose down everything I can see. 10 seconds, and that's probably all I got."
Poole, after 2 seconds of silence, said,
"See you in hell, man."
Darling choked back a laugh because laughing would hurt too badly.
See you in hell.
The line of trucks was only 50 yards away. Some of the Border Patrol shooters knew about where he was, Darling thought. He got a grip on his rifle, which was greasy with his blood, pointed it in the general direction of the trucks, and began firing, emptying the rest of a 30-shot magazine toward them. He hurt so bad that he didn't think he could go on, but managed to pull out the other 30-round magazine, dropped the first one, got the second one seated, and he rolled over toward the glass buildings and dumped the entire magazine into them. He was hit in the head by a shot from behind one of the trucks and was killed instantly. Lucas was shouting at the patrolman, "Easy now, easy! I think we got him! Easy now, watch for that guy out front in case he tries something crazy. Watch him!" Another 10 seconds, and Lucas saw Darling's body in the weeds to his left, and when they'd pulled even with the body, he shouted, "Stop! Trucks all stop!" Without real brakes, the trucks rolled to a ragged stop in the yellow weeds, with Darling off to their left. Lucas called, "I'm going to step over to the left. I think I'm covered by the trucks, but you guys give me more cover. If you see motion over there, kill him." When it seemed that everybody was ready, Lucas risked 5 fast steps over to the body. He recognized Darling from the photo back at the farm, the one with the girls on his lap. He didn't look at all peaceful in death. He looked like he had fallen in a meat grinder, his shirt and pants soaked with blood, with a gaping exit wound over one eye. Lucas turned. "We got one!" A minute later, he was back behind the trucks, and they were rolling toward the area where he thought the second shooter was hiding. Lucas was sweating heavily and smelled of sweat and blood, both his and Bob's, and probably some of Ray's. He wiped his face with a shirt sleeve and brought the rifle back up. "Let's finish it. Drivers, let's go." When Darling opened up on the trucks and then the buildings, Poole crawled out of his concrete bunker flat on the ground and around to the other side of it. From behind it, he couldn't see either of the two domed buildings, but they couldn't see him either, and he was visually protected from the highway by the line of trees that ran parallel both to the line of bunkers and to the highway. He could hear the trucks pushing closer up the open field toward his position. He didn't think the cops knew exactly where he was, but he had no margin for error. He had to move. He stayed flat, pushing mostly with his toes for 100 yards, his rifle in front of him, toward the trees. Tough going, more sand burrs, other thorns and insults. He took a few seconds to wonder if the snakes had already gone underground. He hadn't seen any up to this point, but he didn't want to run into a rattler in the weeds. He didn't. When he'd gotten into the trees, he carefully moved into a clump of heavy brush where he could stand up to see what was going on. Behind him, the trucks were coming on, and in front of him, he could see 3 Border Patrol trucks parked on the highway, with a patrolman standing behind the hood of each one, looking out over the field. Each one with a rifle. He could easily shoot one of them, but then he'd be dead. Between himself and the highway down to his right, he could see 2 long, cigar-shaped white tanks that probably held propane. Off to his left, he could see a white house 2 stories high with a red roof, and behind it a water tower. The thing that most interested him, though, was what looked like a border fence and trees by the house to his left. The trees led all the way from the line of trees that he was in to the highway. There were possibilities that way, but none the other. He went left. He couldn't stand. The trees weren't thick enough, but he could duck walk, which was a lot better than crawling, and it was only 40 or 50 yards. Again, his hands and arms were burning with burrs and thorns, and he could feel them poking through his sweat-soaked shirt into his chest. He tried to ignore them, but couldn't, not the ones in his hands, and he stopped long enough to pull them out. A minute later, he was at the intersection of his long line of trees, with the trees and fence going out to the highway. He made the turn and, moving with glacial slowness, crossed over the wire fence and let himself down into the yard of the red-roofed house. Anyone looking out a window could see him. He hoped they wouldn't do that. He moved forward along the fence line, and a few minutes later, he was at the highway. He couldn't cross it. Too many people could see him, and there was no cover whatever on the far side. But the house had a white stucco wall along the front of the lot. If he crawled north along it, he would be looking into a parking lot with a half dozen cars right across the fence. Lucas had reoriented the line of trucks to move diagonally northeast through the field. When Lucas had nearly gotten himself shot, the shooter must have been at the northeast side of the big field. They were moving straight toward it on a 100-yard front as they'd done with Darling, but nothing was moving. They were approaching the line of Artworks bunkers. Whatever else they might be, they were also perfect firing platforms. When they'd gotten to them with no sign of life, Lucas got the sniper to climb atop one of them where he could see down the arc of bunkers that extended to the south. "If anything moves, nail it," he told the patrolman. On the far side of the bunker, he could see a fairly substantial line of trees 100 yards away. To the patrolman coordinating the trucks, he said, "I'll bet he's in the trees. I'm going to take a couple of guys and go over and work through there. You finish sweeping the field, and if you don't flush him, turn around and back us up." "You take care," the patrolman said. "Yeah, and you too," Lucas said. Lucas got two volunteers, and as the trucks spread out for another sweep, Lucas and the other two men stayed behind them until they could step into the trees. The trees thinned to the south and were more widely spaced, so they turned north. "Like this," Lucas said to the other two. "Always keep a tree directly in front of you. When you get to it, stop moving, keep your rifle up, check out the area in front of you, looking around from behind the tree. When you think it's safe, say so, and the next guy will move past you. Don't ever go more than 10 or 15 feet at a time, so if the shooter pops up, the guy in back will take him out. Got it?" They got it, and they began working their way north. They'd gone only a short distance when they came to a fence and a thinner line of trees leading out to the highway past a red-roofed house. "What do you think?" Lucas asked, his voice quiet. "Go north or out to the highway?" One of the patrolmen said, "The trees look like they're getting thicker the further north they go. If he sticks inside of them, he'll eventually get back to town. He'll have to cross a street to do that," the other one said. "Yeah, but the sun will be down in 15 minutes, and it'll get dark quick. Once it's dark, he could get lost in town," the first one said. "The thing is, he probably doesn't know where the trees lead," Lucas said. Then he said, "Look, you two go on in the trees, really careful. I'm going to take a quick jog out to the highway. If there's nothing out there, I'll be right back. Don't shoot me when I come back." "Let me call everybody and tell them what you're doing," one of the patrolmen said. He took a radio out of a vest pocket, made the call, describing Lucas. "Doesn't have a hat. He's in a light-colored shirt, and he's wearing a vest." When he'd finished the call, they all agreed that they'd all be careful. Lucas climbed the wire fence and began moving out to the highway while the two patrolmen pushed farther north in the trees. Poole had crossed the fence on the north side of the red-roofed house's front yard and sat only partially concealed by a clump of weeds. He'd been moving for a long time, and now, sitting still, his major sensory input was himself. He stank. Ahead of him, not more than 10 or 12 yards away, several cars were parked outside a low building with a sign that said, "El Cosmico." He realized that he'd managed to run in a circle, that he was back to the hippie place with the teepees and weird trailers. There was no traffic on the highway, which had apparently been blocked at both ends of the gunfight. He needed one of those cars, and he needed the driver, because he needed the driver's keys. If he could grab a driver, he could force him into his car, hit him on the head with his .40, shove him onto the floor. The cops would have to open the highway when it got dark. They couldn't keep it closed forever. If he could hold out until then. And he saw a single driver come out of the El Cosmico place, walking toward the cars in front of him. He set his rifle aside, slipped out the .40, waited. She was walking to a car almost directly in front of him. Perfect. The nearest Border Patrol car was 100 yards away, and if he did it quickly and quietly... She came around the back of the car, a tall, thin, red-headed woman, a Texas-looking woman with freckles, her keys in one hand, stepping toward the car. She couldn't go out on the highway. She must have checked into one of the teepees or whatever. Poole stood up and lunged toward her. She didn't see him coming until he was 10 feet away, and he said fairly loudly, because there was nobody else close enough to hear him, "I've got a gun, and if you make any noise or scream, I will shoot you." She dropped the keys and said, "Oh, no, are you?" "Yeah, the cops are gonna kill me if they catch me, so I don't really give a shit at this point." He was right on top of her, took her elbow and said, "Get into the back seat. We're gonna hide out for a while. Keep quiet and you won't get hurt." When she sat down, he thought, one fast hard blow to the head would take her out, maybe permanently. What it was what it was. She was scared, but not quite frozen with fear, said, "My keys." He stooped quickly, picked them up, pushed the button that unlocked the car. "Get in." Lucas had moved slowly down the fence line. Near the end, he saw a border patrolman, one of the ones standing behind a truck, watching him. He stood, waved the rifle over his head, patted his armor. The border patrolman was talking into a radio and a few seconds later waved him on. Lucas moved on up the fence, hurrying now. He could see nothing along it, wanted a quick look along the front of the house, and then he'd get back to the trees. When he'd turned the corner in the front yard, he looked down to his left and saw Poole talking to a red-headed woman beside a gray foreign car. He couldn't see a gun, but Poole was talking rapidly, and the way the woman was standing, Lucas thought he probably had a gun in the hand Lucas couldn't see. He brought the rifle up and walked across the yard, moving as noiselessly as he could. He was completely out in the open, but Poole was talking to the woman and then bent over, and Lucas thought for a second that he'd been seen or heard, but then Poole stood and handed something to the woman. Keys? And Poole said something that Lucas couldn't make out, and Lucas was close enough and shouted, "Poole, if you move, I'll kill you!" But then the woman, who'd been standing beside Poole from Lucas's perspective, lurched between them. Poole, reacting almost instantly, swung his gun hand up around her neck and shouted, "I want a car!" Lucas, looking at him through Bob's red dot sight, saw Poole's head looming behind the woman's, big as a gourd. He didn't listen to what Poole was saying, but concentrated on the red dot and his trigger squeeze and shot Poole through the nose. Poole went down as though somebody had hit him in the face with a fastball, but with his arm still crooked around the woman's neck, and she went down on top of him. The woman started screaming and rolled off the body, and as Lucas walked toward the fence, his gun still up in a shooting position, she got up and ran frantically back toward the El Cosmico building. Lucas crossed the fence, while behind him a couple of Border Patrol trucks revved up. Poole was dead on the ground. The sun had just hit the horizon, scarlet rays playing across the gravel parking lot and over the supine body, which was leaking blood into the parking lot.
The El Cosmico door slammed as the woman lurched inside, and Lucas looked down at Poole and said, "Gotcha." Chapter 28. The four women had seen any number of unusual things on their way south to Marfa, including a huge white blimp called a radar aerostat, according to the sign outside the launch site. When Rosie looked it up on her smartphone, it turned out it was a radar platform used to search for low-flying drug planes coming across from Mexico.
"Wonder if they've got one for low-flying drug RVs," Annie joked. Only Rosie chuckled.
Annie was driving now. Rosie was putting together cheeseburgers in the RV's tiny kitchen, and the vehicle was suffused with the smell of cooking meat. The countryside was new to Box, who hadn't been much west or south of Dallas, even though she and Gar had lived in Texas for 5 years. The Marfa area had low, funky-looking mountains, lots of yellow grass and weeds, and alien-looking roadside plants with 9-foot-tall stems that stuck up out of palms, or maybe cactuses, or possibly aliens. They'd finished eating the cheeseburgers when the lights of Marfa came up in the gathering dusk. Then, not far ahead, they could see the red-blinking lights of a checkpoint and only 3 vehicles waiting to go through. Annie said, "Uh-oh. Rosie, get those 2 out of sight. Now, hurry, I don't want to slow down." Rosie pulled the floor up, and Box and Court stuffed themselves into the hole, lying side by side. There was space above their heads and below their feet, but not more than 6 inches above their noses. When Rosie slammed the door back into place, everything went pitch black.
"You crazy fucking bitch! You got us into this," Court growled at Box. "Shut the fuck up. I'm really fucking tired of your whining all the time," Box snarled back. "Shit."
Court threw an elbow into Box's ribs hard enough to hurt. There wasn't enough height to swing, but Box reached over with one hand and grabbed Court by the lips and twisted. Court let go with a muffled scream and beat awkwardly at Box with one fist, and then Rosie started stomping on the floor and shouted,
"Shut up! Shut up! We're coming to it!"
Box let go of Court's lips, and Court said,
"When we get out of here, I'm gonna beat the shit out of you."
"Fuck you some more," Box said.
They felt the RV braking to a stop. Up above, Annie opened the RV's front door and a border patrolman asked,
"Evening, ladies. Do you have any other passengers?"
"No," Annie said. "What's going on? Is there trouble?"
"We've had a problem with some men trying to get down to the border at Presidio. Are you on your way to Presidio?"
Annie shook her head.
"No, sir. We're going to Marfa to see the Donald Judd exhibits. Is there trouble in Marfa?"
"You should be okay in Marfa. Do you mind if I take a peek inside?"
He lowered his voice.
"We want to make sure you don't have a gun pointed at you or anything."
"Sure, come on in," Annie said.
The officer climbed the first step, looked down the length of the RV, and said,
"If you're going to make a break from a kidnapper, now's the time."
"There's nobody else here," Rosie said.
The officer backed down the steps and smiled and said,
"You're fine. Have a good time in Marfa. It's a great little place. Go see the Marfa lights."
"We will,"
Annie said, and rolled them through the checkpoint. When they were well away, Rosie wondered, "If our maps are right, this museum place is all the way down to the end of town. Wonder why they're checking vehicles coming into town."
"I suppose looking for what we're doing. Maybe a rescue attempt by another person, like Dora or Court," Annie said.
Rosie glanced back at the neat blue carpet that concealed the smuggling space.
I'm tempted to leave them in there. Of course, maybe they're already dead.
That'd solve a lot of problems, but I suppose you ought to let them out.
When Rosie opened the floor hatch, Box, the smaller and more lithe of the two women, Court was to lithe as a packing crate is to agile, virtually sprang out of the enclosure and said,
"Everything's okay?"
"We're fine. The cop said so himself," Rosie replied.
Court was struggling to get out of the smuggling space, the bottom half of her face as red as a Coke can where Box had twisted it. Rosie finally reached down, took her hand, and helped pull her up.
"I ought to kill you right now," Court said to Box.
Box sat on the couch, looked at Annie and then Rosie, ignoring Court, and asked,
"What's the plan now?"
"We're gonna get as far south as we can and see what's going on. We're gonna want you two sitting down so nobody can see you from the outside. If we need to get you back in the hold, you gotta go quick. We'll leave the door open," Rosie said. "Nobody knows about me and Annie, but everybody's looking for you two. We think that checkpoint was for somebody looking to rescue Poole or kill him, which would be you, Dora, or you, Charlene."
"Shouldn't be doing this at all," Court said.
"Yeah, well, we are," Rosie said.
They took it slow going through town, a somewhat scruffy-looking place with lots of vacant lots and tumble-down houses, but some nice downtown buildings as well. They took the turn onto Highway 67, south toward the border. They'd only gone a few blocks when they saw what looked like a law enforcement convention on the right side of the highway, cop cars and border patrol vehicles with flashing lights, and cops walking around unhurriedly.
"Okay, that's bad," Rosie said. "The cops aren't worried."
Box:
"Are you saying?"
"That's what I'm saying, honey. I'm sorry."
"You knew it was likely," Rosie said.
Up ahead, a cop was directing cars off the highway onto a detour to the east. They took the detour, realized that it would take them all the way out of town, and followed some other cars on a loop back into town. Across the highway, they could see bright lights in the parking lot of a place called El Cosmico, and a circle of cops, like a football huddle, looking at something on the ground.
Buck said, "Oh, God. Oh, my God."
"Easy, honey," Rosie said.
After a minute, Annie said, "That's not where Poole said the truck was. It could still be out there. Think we can find it? I'm kind of lost here."
"Glad you asked," Rosie said. She went back to one of the storage closets, got out her laptop and the Verizon hotspot, plugged in the hotspot, and brought up the laptop. With a few keystrokes, she was on Google Maps and then the satellite view.
"Here's where we are," she said, tapping the screen. "From what Poole told us, the truck has got to be right here." She touched the screen. "If we go over here to Waco Street and then west all the way and then down to here and back east on Catherine Street, we ought to be able to look right at the trucks. If there are three white pickups and nobody around them..."
"Gonna have to hurry. The cops will be looking for it," Annie said.
"Then let's go," Rosie said. They followed the line that Rosie had laid out on the map, and Court kept her mouth shut for once. Coming back on Catherine, they could look right into the parking area where the three trucks were. The trucks were still there, all three of them, and so was a big light generator and a dozen cops around the middle truck. The back of the truck was open, and Court, peeking out through a side window, said,
"Shit! It's that guy. The Davenport guy, the cop we were tracking. They got the truck."
"So we're done with it. Now we get out of here," Rosie said. "You guys get back. We're coming up to a cop. Back in the floor."
Box and Court scuttled back to the hidden hold and dropped inside, lying side by side again. Up above, a cop was waving Annie around the corner and away from the cops in the parking area. Annie took it slow, and they left the lights behind. Rosie opened the lid on the hold. "We're going. You're both still alive?" Box and Court climbed out of the hold, and Court turned on Box and said, "Now it's you and me." Rosie tried to intervene, but Court, who was strong, shoved her in the chest, nearly knocking her on her butt, and a second later, Court swung at Box, hitting her in the eye. Box fell back on the couch, and Court put one knee up on the seat cushion, getting ready for a couple more punches. But Box was groping under the cushion, came up with the Phillips screwdriver, and as Court's eyes widened for a fraction of a second, Box drove the screwdriver right through Court's frontal bone, 2 inches above her eyeline. Court staggered backward and then fell on her ass, propped up against the pots and pans drawer. Rosie was back and she stared down at Court. The red-striped plastic handle of a Craftsman screwdriver was snug against the skin of Court's forehead, the shaft of the screwdriver deep in her brain. Rosie said, "Oh, my God." Annie picked up the tone and, glancing back over her shoulder, asked, "What?" "Dora stuck a screwdriver in Charlene's brain." "What?" Rosie bent lower and said, "She's not dead."
"Let me stir it around a little bit and she'll be dead," Buck said. "I had enough of her shit."
"No kidding," Rosie said. "Remind me not to piss you off."
"Now what?"
Annie called. "You ought to find a place to pull over and come and look at this," Rosie said. Annie pulled into a dark side street, pushed herself out of the driver's seat, and came to look. A thin stream of blood, but not really much, trickled out of the screwdriver hole and down the center of Court's nose.
"She was a monster," Box said.
She was standing back a bit, her arms crossed defensively as if anticipating criticism.
"She deserved what she got."
"Still not dead," Rosie said.
"Hasn't even closed her eyes," Annie said.
She tapped Court on the shoulder, then gave her a little push. Nothing on Court's face changed, and she made no noise at all. She didn't blink.
"Still not dead," Rosie said. "She's breathing. She's got a screwdriver in her brain, a steel rod. How come she's not dead?"
"Don't know," Annie said.
Court blinked. "Now what?" Box asked.
Annie shook her head.
"I'll tell you what, Dora. This really isn't good. I'm not really up for finishing her off."
She scratched the side of her face, peering at Court, who still hadn't moved except to blink.
"What are we going to do?" Rosie asked Annie.
"Well, I guess we could drop her off somewhere," Annie said. "Wouldn't make much difference to her wherever we left her. Wouldn't want anybody to see us doing it."
"She could identify us," Box said.
"If she could find us. But we're not from around here, and she doesn't know our last names or anything," Annie said.
"I say we stir that screwdriver handle around a little," Box said.
Court blinked.
"We won't have to worry about her identifying anything."
"I got a feeling she won't be doing that anyway," Annie said. Rosie stood up. "Okay, let's go." They went looking for a place, and as they did, Box cleaned her fingerprints off the screwdriver handle with a hand wipe. They eventually found a closed Stripes convenience store and dropped Court off between a couple of gas pumps. Court sat between the pumps like an oversized lump of modeling clay, still staring straight ahead, blinked once. As they pulled away, Rosie asked the other two, "Think she'll be all right there?" Annie shook her head and said,
No, I don't think so.
10 minutes behind them, a tourist pulled into the stripes, hoping that it might still be open. It wasn't, but he saw the figure sitting between the gas pumps, and though he didn't want to, stepped over and took a look. His wife called from the car,
"Larry, come back. Leave her to sleep it off."
Larry walked around the car and said,
"I think we should call the police.
She's probably a drug addict."
"She could be," Larry said.
"Her bigger problem seems to be that she's got a screwdriver stuck into her brain."
Annie, Rosie, and Box drove north out of Marfa. They'd grown silent after the court incident and were 30 miles up the road before Rosie asked Annie,
"What do we do about the Dora problem?"
Box spoke up before Annie could answer.
"Listen, the three of us could get along. Now, I need to tell you something, and I need to ask you something. You talk about this boss and how he sort of cheapskates you on the money?"
"Yeah, but we don't mention it to his face," Rosie said.
"Well, the boss is gonna find out that the money is gone, right? That the feds got it," Box said. "It'll be in the newspapers. The cops will be showing off. Nothing you could do about that. You did your best."
"He won't be happy, but he won't take it out on us," Rosie said. "He's pretty rational."
Box nodded.
"Okay, good. He's rational. Now, what if I told you I know where there's almost $1.5 million, more or less, in cash and gold a few hours from here? Nobody knows about it but me. Nobody knows."
Rosie and Annie glanced at each other, and then Annie asked Rosie, "What's that movie line you like from the famous movie?"
"I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship," Rosie said.
Annie pointed a finger at her.
"That's the one."
Chapter 29. A deep and sullen silence seemed to drape the town of Marfa after the firefight in the fields beside the highway. The border patrol kept people away from the buildings where the shooting took place, except for a couple of employees of the Chinati Foundation, which ran the place. The state cops were called in to process the shooting scenes, but wouldn't get there until the next day. The bodies were left where they fell, covered with black plastic tarps, and watched by border patrolmen as much to keep the coyotes away as to protect the scenes. Shortly after the last fight, a helicopter roared in from El Paso and took Bob away. Lucas met Ray wandering around by the Foundation headquarters, put an arm around her shoulders.
"How is he?"
"Oh, he'll be okay. Take some time, some rehab. The medics slowed down the blood loss. He was still okay when they loaded him into the chopper.
You talked to your SOG people yet?"
"No, I haven't gotten around to it. I'm sort of stunned," she said.
"So's everybody. Let's find a place to sit. You can call your guys. I'll call Fort and fill him in."
They did that. Everybody was unhappy about Bob. Everybody was happy that Poole and Darling were dead.
"Five people murdered at one spot, including that kid," Fort said. "We needed to take them off the board any way we could. Not to go all bureaucratic on you, I'd like the names of all the Border Patrol and Highway Patrol people who cooperated with you. When we put out the press release, we'll go big time on the help they gave us. This will be a nice story tomorrow. Give us a chance to put some serious grease in the wheels. And, say, did you find any cash or gold? That could be big."
"Tell you about that in an hour or so," Lucas said. "I think I know where their vehicle is."
After he got off the phone, Lucas told Ray about the grease comment, and she said,
I don't know about you former small-time cops, but Greece is close to the top consideration with the federal government. Might even be the top. Don't care who got killed, how many got killed, but they do care about the Greece. You okay? Lucas asked. Shoulder hurts. Medic looked at it, said it's a bunch of cuts. He gave me some antibiotic cream for it, told me to see a doc as soon as I can. How about you? You look a lot worse than me, that bloody rag around your head. Got a little headache, that's about it, Lucas said. Scared the hell out of me when I couldn't see at first. How's your eye now? Ray asked. I can see fine, but my eye is watering a lot. Let's go find one of those medics. Take a quick look. They found a medic who looked at Lucas's eye with a magnifier, said he couldn't see much, but that Lucas's eye was bloodshot. He irrigated the eye, which made it feel worse than it had before the irrigation. The medic said that was normal. He then washed off Lucas's forehead, said there was a lot of brick dust embedded in the skin above his eye. He suggested that Lucas have a doctor check it. If you get an infection, it could leave some scarring. Go see a doc. Ray told him the SOG people were mostly concerned about Bob and would fly a couple of supervisors into El Paso to talk with him.
Gonna ask him if you fucked up is what they're going to do, Ray said. I already told them you didn't, that we were all great, but there's gonna have to be an after-action report. Hope you're ready for a blizzard of paper.
Wanna see an even greater blizzard? Lucas asked. Follow me and listen carefully. He led Ray around the buildings to the place where he'd first seen Darling crossing a fence into the field. He was carrying a bag. He lost it somewhere along the way, and I gotta believe he'd dumped the truck right where he was crossing into that field. There are three white trucks parked by the buildings, Ray said.
Money.
Let's get some lights and more witnesses. They rounded up O'Brien, the Border Patrol boss, and Gutierrez, the highway patrolman who'd led them down from I-10, and a couple of other guys, everybody armed with heavy-duty flashlights. They located the place where Darling had crossed the fence by the crushed-down weeds on the other side, and 6 feet into the field found a light brown canvas duffel bag. Lucas pulled it open. Inside was some paper, two passports, and enough cash, as Gutierrez put it, to choke a Texas hog. O'Brien said,
We know about cash seizures. Bring that bag out of here, and I'll have a couple of our guys count it, with witnesses.
Ray said, That might not be all of it. Lucas thinks he knows where Darling ditched his truck. Lucas swiveled his flashlight across the dark field to the buildings, to a line of white pickups parked behind it. Let's get that museum lady out here. She should know who belongs to which trucks. The museum lady did know. The two trucks on the ends were a museum truck and a truck that belonged to a museum worker. The one in the middle, the one with the Arkansas plates, she didn't know. But she didn't want to talk about that. She wanted somebody to take her down to the two dome-topped buildings that were at the center of the fight.
Why won't you let me down there? Why?
Crime scene, O'Brien muttered, and then they ignored her. Lucas tried the truck's driver's side door, and it popped open. He shone his flash around the inside, spotted the keys on the floor. Two border patrolmen took a long look at the truck's interior, then they all went around to the back and popped the hatch on the camper top. There were some bags inside, full of clothing and paper, but no money. Then one patrolman said to another,
Carlos, does that floor look right?
Carlos squatted by the back of the truck, squinted at the floor, then looked beneath it, and then at the floor again, and finally said,
It's a few inches high.
Not much, but a few.
The first patrolman crawled into the truck and, with the rest of them watching, began pulling and tugging and prying at pieces of the interior and finally popped up a hidden hatch.
"That's good work right there," he said of the hatch. "Somebody give me a flashlight."
He shone the flashlight into the hatch, then got his head down closer to the floor.
"Madre de Dios!"
Ray.
"Mom sees money?"
The patrolman looked up.
"Mom sees a buttload of cash and what looks like a pile of gold coins in a plastic box,"
Lucas said to O'Brien.
"Gonna need more counters, more witnesses,"
Ray said.
"Hot damn!"
Nobody noticed the RV crawl past them a couple hundred yards away. Because of all the accounting rigmarole, they didn't know until 10 o'clock that they'd found $3.2 million in currency and about $600,000 in gold coins, the amount of gold value dependent on the market. O'Brien pronounced himself pleased. He linked his fingers across his ample belly and said,
"I'm pleased." Ray said, "Fucking A."
Lucas called Fort at home with the count. Fort said,
"I'm far too suave to say it gives me a hard-on, but right now I definitely got a party in my pants."
Lucas paid no attention to O'Brien when he finally told the persistent museum lady that he'd have a patrolman escort her to the domed buildings. She and a patrolman disappeared a moment later. Bob called from El Paso.
"They didn't want to let me talk, but I am anyway. They're telling me I'll be down for a couple of months, including rehab. They're going to take me into the operating room as soon as this nurse stops washing off my dick."
"Yes, you are. You're washing my dick. Don't try to sneak around it."
"And it'll be a while before I come out. I'll call as soon as I wake up tomorrow. You find any money?"
They were telling him about the money when a woman started screaming. Lucas said,
"Oh, shit,"
and picked up his armor and Bob's rifle and followed Ray at a dead run around the buildings and then around the second set of buildings, and saw the museum lady shrieking while a patrolman tried to placate her. Lucas and Ray stopped running and took it slower, and when they came up with their guns, the wild-eyed woman looked at them and screamed,
"You killed my Judds! You killed my Judds!"
The milled aluminum boxes they'd seen behind the glass were neither kitchen appliances, Ray, nor boxes for holding the art, Lucas, but were, in fact, the art itself. Of the 100 boxes in two buildings, 12 had either through-and-through bullet holes or bullet gashes. All the windows in the first building had been shattered or cracked, but the woman wasn't worried about the windows. Ray asked her the wrong question.
"You're sure this happened tonight?"
The woman began screaming incomprehensibly, literally tearing at her hair, dashing from one aluminum box to the next, looking for more damage. When she'd finished her survey, only slightly calmed down, she said to O'Brien, the senior officer in uniform,
"You don't know what you've done."
"We were fighting it out with crazy killers," he said.
"You managed to destroy millions and millions of dollars worth of irreplaceable art."
A patrolman in the back muttered, loud enough for everyone to hear,
"Shit, I could get a load of those up at the Home Depot."
They all turned to look at him. Not at all embarrassed, he added,
"in a variety of decorator colors."
Somebody laughed, which made the woman cry again, and then everybody felt bad for a while. They were still milling around, checking periodically with the highway patrol for possible sightings of Dora Box, when O'Brien hurried out of the Foundation office and said to Lucas and Ray,
"We need to get over to the Stripes station."
What for?
A woman's been stabbed in the head. A sheriff's deputy thinks she might be this court woman you're looking for. They made it to the Stripe station in 5 minutes, where the two overworked EMTs were staring at a woman who was seated on the concrete next to a gas pump. They walked past a cop who was keeping rubberneckers away, and one of the EMTs said, "We called for the chopper again. I don't know what we can do here." Lucas took a look. The woman was Court, all right, sitting straight up, her eyes fixed and peering straight ahead, with a screwdriver handle sticking out from her forehead. Lucas asked, "Is she alive?" "Yeah, she blinks every 20 seconds," the EMT said. "We've tried to communicate with her, but nothing happens. We ask her to blink or move a finger if she hears us, but she doesn't respond. She doesn't blink on command. When we try to pick her up, her legs don't work. We need the chopper and a neurosurgeon. This is not something you throw a bandage on." "Anybody know how she got here?" Ray asked. The EMTs shrugged, and a sheriff's deputy who'd come over to listen in said, "A tourist found her. He thought the station was open and pulled in and saw her sitting by the pump. He thought she was a drug addict until he saw the screwdriver handle. Nobody knows how long she was sitting here or who dropped her off." O'Brien leaned down and waved his hands in front of Court's eyes. She didn't blink. He took his hand away, and a few seconds later, she did blink. "Every 20 seconds, the EMT said. "You could set your watch by it." An hour later, she was flown out of Marfa for El Paso, still blinking every 20 seconds. The next morning, Lucas spoke to a doc in El Paso who said that Court had died an hour earlier during an operation to remove the screwdriver. She had some brain function, and the neuro guy had her coked to the gills with anti-seizure medicine, but as soon as they removed the screwdriver, she had a massive seizure and died. She also has a recent bullet wound in her butt, and apparently self-treated that. Anyway, she's gone. Lucas hung up, and as he punched in Fort's phone number to report Court's death, he thought, "Coked to the gills?" When he told Ray about it, she said, "That's just Texas." Later that day, Lucas and Ray went to El Paso to see Bob, who was looking good, given the fact that he'd been shot through both legs. "Biggest question now is whether I have vascular damage," he said. "I can wiggle all my toes, and if somebody pinches my knees, it hurts, so no major nerves were killed off, as far as anyone can tell. Take a while to find all that out, but I won't lose any legs. I could be back in a couple of months." "That's good, because our boy Davenport wants us to work with him on his next big one," Ray said. "Business class, suites, hotels?" Bob asked. "Count on it," Lucas said. When they left Bob, they both went to the emergency room, where a nurse practitioner rewashed their not-very-bad wounds and pronounced them okay, although they should have gotten more comprehensive treatment about 15 hours earlier. On the way back to Marfa, Lucas said to Ray, "Bob's hurt worse than he lets on. He'll be doing good if he's back by next summer. He might even be able to cash his chips on a disability if he wants that."
"He won't. He'll be back," Ray teared up. "I wish I could shoot that motherfucker Darling again."
That same day, Rosie pulled the RV off the road near Gordon, Texas. There wasn't anyone around, and they carefully and watchfully walked the interstate fence until they spotted the orange blouse. The three of them, Rosie and Annie and Dora, hauled the two black cases out of the weeds under the pine tree. Dora popped them open, and Annie said, "Oh!" in what was nothing less than an orgasmic groan.
"Let's get them back to the RV," Dora said, "and let me get my blouse."
She unknotted her blouse from the fence pole, and Annie came up from behind her,
put one hand on the pole and the other on Box's ass and asked, "Little kiss?" A guy going by in an 18-wheeler looked up and saw them and said to himself, "Oh, no, 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 no way. Oh, man, don't do that to me. Not 10 days from home." Lucas and Ray were back in Marfa in quite a nice hotel for the next 3 days in the predicted blizzard of paperwork. The hotel people wanted them out of their rooms as soon as possible because of an enormous influx of art lovers there to inspect the damage. A good-looking young woman called Lucas, who had been identified to her as one of the lead cops, a fascist. Ray asked, "Me too?" The young woman looked at the tall black woman and seemed to struggle for a moment with all the possible politically correct replies and got off the elevator without attempting one. With the paperwork done, the crime scene measured and discussed, sworn statements given, Lucas kissed Ray on the forehead at the El Paso airport and said, "Rubber match, next time we hook up. Work on your game." "Like I need it," she said, and, "You take care, big guy." She took her business class tickets and walked down the jetway and out of sight. That same day, John Steiner was hired to be an assistant manager at a new Starbucks in Tampa, Florida. The Starbucks regional man said, "We're quite impressed with your qualifications. Year or two, you could be running your own store." "I'm looking forward to it, sir," Steiner said, and thought privately, "How in the fuck do you look at yourself in the morning, you boring, paper-pushing cocksucker? I'm really anxious to make Starbucks my future. And maybe getting in the shorts of one of your tight little baristas, or maybe more than one." On the very same day, a team of marshals swarmed Darling's Alabama farm. They found nothing, but one agent spotted a heap of raw dirt across the road from the house in some brush. He brought Janice Darling across the road to look at it. "It's a gopher, you dummy," she told him. He was from New York City and didn't know gophers from wolverines, and so accepted her answer. She had dug up and moved the money the day before. In a year, she thought, she'd be in Toronto under a new name and still desperately missing Sturgill. On a bright Tuesday, a couple of days after he got back, Lucas and Weather drove to their polling place where they voted for Mrs. Bowden for president. That night, they went to a Bowden victory party, which didn't work out all that well. By 10 o'clock, people were slinking out of the place. "Wolf Blitzer can kiss my ass," one of the partiers told Lucas as they shuffled down the sidewalk. Virgil Flowers, a BCA agent and old friend, was in town the next day and stopped by to check on him. He cut through the post-election gloom. "Hey, man, the world goes on, you know what I mean? Go out in the backyard, burn some steaks, fire up a doobie, relax. Oh, and tell me about Marfa." There were no doobies to be had, but they burned some steaks and, with the cold weather moving in, ate at the dining table, drank some Lineys, and Lucas told them all about it. He said, "I'll tell you, Virgil, things are getting strange out there. This whole case was pinned on, guess what? Let me see. Couldn't be intelligent investigation, we can rule that out. Telephones. Everybody was leaning on telephones." Lucas took a phone from his pocket and held it up, then looked at it, at the shiny black glass. "They're so great, these little machines are, that we all agree to be spied on for the privilege of carrying them. The phones know where we've been, when we were there, and lots of time, what we were doing there, what we were buying, who we were talking to, and where those people were. They can even tell how fast you were moving, in case somebody wants to prove you were speeding. They know who you talk to, who your contacts are, what credit cards you have, where you bank. We all know that, but we can't get away from them. Even crooks know it, and even they can't get away from them. All you'd have to do is not have one, Flowers said. You can't do that. Listen to me, you can't do that anymore, Lucas said. What if you left your phone at home and had a heart attack or rolled your car over on a back road? How would you call 911 to ask for help? And if you're a crook and leave your phone at home while you're sticking up a bank, but you carry it all the rest of the time, you automatically look suspicious. You always carry the phone, and this one time during the bank robbery, you left it at home. I don't think so. Sooner or later, some prosecutor will convict somebody of something because he didn't have a phone in his pocket. You need another drink, Flowers said. And, say, how's Letty doing? Is she coming home for Christmas? Maybe I'll call her up. Only at the risk of your life, Lucas said. What, you'd shoot me for calling up Letty? Oh, no. I'd just tell Frankie, Lucas said. Frankie was Virgil's girlfriend and not a stranger to violence. I'd say, Frankie? Guess what? Flowers held up his hands. All right, all right. Joking there about Letty. On the Monday after the election, Lucas, still with a bandage on his forehead, went into the marshal's offices in Minneapolis carrying his briefcase, which contained nothing but the paper from the pool case. Hal Oder, the U.S. Marshal for the District of Minnesota, saw Lucas in the hallway unlocking his office door and called, "Davenport! My office!" Lucas finished unlocking his door and dropped his briefcase next to his desk, hearing the footfalls clacking down the hall. Then Oder shoved his head in the doorway and snapped, "Don't tell me you didn't hear me." "I heard you, but I ignored you," Lucas said. "Things are gonna change around here," Oder said. "You don't have Bowden watching your back anymore. If you expect to stay here, you're going on a duty roster. You're going to be pulling regular shifts, and that includes prisoner transfer. I'm going to..." Lucas put a finger to his lips, and when Oder stopped talking, said, "Hal, you really shouldn't say anything more until tomorrow afternoon, after your appointment." Lucas saw the fear suddenly flare in Oder's eyes. "What appointment?" "You have an appointment, you just don't know it yet. Now get the fuck out of my office." The following afternoon, Oder had begun to relax. He'd checked with his secretary every 15 minutes about unexpected appointments, and there hadn't been any. Davenport had been bullshitting him, for reasons Oder couldn't figure out. Then, at 1:45, a message popped up on the corner of his computer. It said, "Your appointments are here." Oder went to the door where he saw the Democratic governor of Minnesota, the man who, until the week before, had been expected to become Mrs. Bowden's vice president, walking down the hall toward him. He was trailed by another man, a short man carrying a shovel. Oder didn't recognize the short man for a moment, then realized that he was Porter Smalls, the once-and-future Republican U.S. Senator from Minnesota. The governor smiled and thrust out a hand, said, "Hal, I think we've met a couple of times. How are you?"
Is this about Davenport?" Oder asked as he shook the governor's hand.
The future Senator Small said, "Yes, yes, it is. Let's go in your office and talk about it."
His shovel still had the sales stickers on the face of the blade. Odor didn't ask about it. When they were settled into the office, Smalls said,
"I will now tell you a short story. 2 years ago, Senator Taryn Grant, the bitch from hell, had some child porn put on my campaign computer, then murdered her way through the election and into the U.S. Senate. Into my seat. This is not a secret. Tell your children about it if you wish. The governor here is an old friend, and though we're in opposing political parties, he knew that I was innocent. He assigned Lucas to find out what happened. Lucas did. I was cleared of the child porn stories too late to keep me from losing my Senate seat, but at least I didn't go to prison. When it's all said and done, though, Minnesotans remember. If you watched the elections last week, did you watch the elections?
Yes, I did, Odor said.
Good. Then you'll know that I'm going back to the Senate in a landslide. I wouldn't be doing that if it weren't for Marshall Davenport. Of all the law enforcement officials I've met in my life, of all of them, and there have been many, he is far and away my favorite. Am I making myself clear?
Yes, you are, Odor said.
Good.
Smalls turned to Henderson and said,
"Anything you want to say, Elmer?"
"Nothing, except that there's an excellent chance I'll be running for Taryn Grant's Senate seat in the primary the next time it comes up. I believe I can beat her. Lucas is also my favorite law enforcement officer, though he can be a pain in the ass at times. In any case, both Senator Smalls and I expect that he will spend many happy years working here as a deputy marshal, without interference from anyone, including politically appointed personnel." Odor didn't say anything but looked from the governor to the senator, his face going red. The two politicians stood and smiled, and Smalls said,
"I bought this shovel for you. You can leave it in a corner to remind yourself,"
Odor managed.
"Of what?" "Of the fact that if you mess with Lucas, you'll probably never again have a white-collar job, certainly not with the federal or state governments. So you might need a shovel, and you'll have one right handy."
Henderson, a tall man, leaned forward, put his fists on the edge of Odor's desk.
"I'm a very polite upper-class Anglo-Saxon male, and I only rarely stoop to use unpleasant language. There are some exceptions. This is one of them. I'm telling you, Hal, don't fuck with him. Don't fuck with him."
Odor nodded. Smalls looked around the office and asked,
"Where do you want me to stick the shovel?"
This is Richard Ferrone. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Golden Prey by John Sanford. This program was directed by John McElroy, executive producer Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2017 by John Sanford. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.